Okay, back to my topic. And I'll take more questions at the end, too, if you still have some. So I'd like to talk a little bit about just what these some of these words mean and in the way that we hold them, and I think it's helpful. And the first big one I need to start with is really this word, addiction, which is really has a lot of stigma culturally, of course, and because of the anonymity aspects of the 12 steps can almost have a shame component built into it, unfortunately. And also I think that we want to really acknowledge that, and probably especially from a meditative or Dharma perspective, addiction isn't a noun. It's not something that I have. It's something that has happened to me. So it's really, I think, helpful to see addiction as a verb, as something that, that has movement to it. It's not a thing that I am, but it is a process that has happened to me, and maybe even a process that I happen to still be in. So we define it as addiction is really a behavior. So it's a behavior. And it's any behavior, thinking or acting. So in Buddhist psychology, we would identify thinking as a behavior. So there's planning, there's worrying, there's remembering. There's lots of behaviors, thinking behaviors. And it's any thinking behavior or tactile action behavior that what it's trying to do, the attempt, is to avoid, change, or control something about the present moment that seems unbearable. Have you ever been in a present moment experience and you thought to yourself, I cannot handle this right now? Mm-hmm. Right? And so when I'm in that unbearable moment, I have to think something or I have to engage in some behavior because I want to avoid it. I need to avoid this, and I need to change this, or I need to control this. And if I can't avoid it or change it, you better believe I'm going to control it. And that's, of course, the messiest of all three, is trying to control the conditions. And then the delusion that I can control the conditions. And so it's a behavior process. It's a verb. It's something that we do. And if we've been in unbearable moments early in our life, whether they were traumatic or just really, really difficult, or having episodic experiences over and over again, whatever worked to alleviate the unbearableness will repeat that. So it could have just been having a sip of alcohol or taking a pill or watching TV or whatever our escape mechanism was, that's what we default to. So that's really the first half of the definition, is a behavior, thinking or action that is seeking to avoid, change, or control the unbearable conditions of the present moment. The second part is that this process, this behavior, produces short-term relief, but it creates long-term harm. So it works in the shorthand. It works in the heat of the moment. But what happens on the other side of that is this long-term harm. It's like a credit card with, 89% APR on it. So you can have the flat screen now, but you're going to pay $4,000 for it. It's that kind of thing. And this is why I think the numbers are so low, and this is why the thing is so tragic, because in the heat of the moment, it's really, really hard not to take the short-term relief. Especially if the unbearable moment is, and a lot of us have been through really, really difficult things, especially if they're physical, emotional, it's really, really hard to not just do the thing that worked last time. So it's really kind of this circular process. Difficult moment. I got to avoid it, got to change it, got to control it. I'll do this thing. I'll get some relief. And then what happens is all these problems and conflicts and situations, they just start piling and piling and piling and piling and piling. And that's sort of how that works. And it's a verb. It's something that happens to us. It's learned. It's been conditioned. It's something that we've learned, which is reassuring because it can also be unlearned. If it can be installed, it can be removed. But it's not a switch. It's not like something that you switch off, just like it's not something that you switched on. It's something that is going to probably take a while. And the thing about it that I think is so hard And the thing about it that, again, is so tragic, is as human beings, really what we're doing to overcome addiction is we're choosing, to some degree, we're choosing to deal with very, very difficult experiences. Right? We're choosing to not take the medicine. We're choosing a discomfort. We're choosing fear and pain and uncertainty and doubt. We're choosing to do something that we've never, ever done before. And that's really scary and really, really hard. And you didn't, then you have to maintain it. You don't just do it one time. You have to learn how to maintain that kind of process of being able to do that. And so that's one of the reasons why I think we are in such the epidemic that we're in with all of this. And also, too, we live in a world where I think it's maybe safe to say that for a variety of reasons, media, digital devices, all kinds of different things, the world's a really, really difficult place to navigate right now. You know, there's lots of, you know, epic, catastrophic things on a global scale we can get consumed by. That is really, really the mind adjusting to the world and the media and globalization and the way that we get our news feeds and everything. We're just totally overloaded with data. So that makes it a little bit harder. And then also the delivery system for our addictive behaviors. The world is like a buffet for addictive behaviors. So the mechanism for getting the short-term relief, it can be as simple as picking up my phone or eating something. Or watching something that it's and it's just giving into this distraction, which is a very subtle, you know. That's why I pointed out in the meditation tonight. A lot of times when I'm having a very, very even subtle, not even recognizable, unpleasant kind of experience, I reach for the self-medicative process of distraction. I just don't want to be with this. I want something else. And distractions are plenty available. And that's the most subtle and sort of insidious way that that works. So if we think about recovery, well, that's addiction, if we can get behind that. Does that make sense? Does that sound about right? It's also I feel much more compassionate. We could actually maybe say that addiction is just self-medication. I would love to go into a meeting and say, my name is Dave and I'm a self-medicator. And I still am, you know, I still every day I do something to alleviate myself from difficult experiences. The destructiveness of that has gotten a zillion times better than it once was. But it's still there, right? It's still there. So then recovery also, a word that I've always been confused by, I'm like, what is recovery? If I use that addiction definition, recovery is also a verb, I think. It's something that we do. Recovery is a skill. And it's really the ability to inhabit the conditions of the present moment, whether they're painful or pleasant. It's just learning how to be in the mind-body system, learning how to be in the present experience without having to avoid something or change it or control it, being able to be in the present moment experience without needing anything extra, needing things to be different, having what we, you know, having some tolerance and some resilience, and you know, this isn't great, but I can do this, which also gives rise to a whole bunch of other really constructive mind states of things like confidence and trust and ability. So so even if we clock it, recovery even on a moment to moment level, it's literally recovering from the fact that your mind was wandering and coming back to that wake-up moment. That's a recovery. You've recovered your attention. In fact, in the stages of attention training, one of the stages, the third stage is recovering your attention, recovering from that wandering mind. So every time you do that, and you sit for 30 minutes, you probably do that, 100 times, right? That's, you're really, really building really great skills in doing that. It doesn't have to be this epic thing. There's a way in which the mind just can recover from wandering. So that's the first part of being able to really inhabit and to be present in the conditions of the moment, whether they're painful or not, or they're pleasant or not, being able to do that. Mindfulness and most Buddhist contemplative practices will really, really help you with that. And then to take it a step further, I think also is we do have to, part of recovery is learning really, I don't like this word so much, I can't think of a better one, but really learning how to heal the underlying conditions or the underlying installations that gave rise to the addiction in the first place, which is really to some degree dealing with the things that have happened in the past in the variety of ways in which one can do that. There's no sort of tried or true Dharma perspective on that, but there can be this kind of delusion, I think, because of the emphasis on the present moment. Sometimes we can get in this delusion to think that because of that, that we're going to get like this clean slate moment where everything that happened in the past is no longer relevant. Whether it's relevant or not is irrelevant because it's affecting you. You know, what has happened to us in the past? There's actually a great book on trauma called When the Past is Present. And I don't know about you, but the past is often present with me. So there's a way in which, whether we do recovery skills or therapy, or there's a whole range of things we can do, but at some point, most people that I've encountered find that we have to kind of deal with the past on some level. And some of the really the easiest ways to do that is just to be willing to continue to have a conversation with it without necessarily even any, you know, trying to come to any sense of closure, but a willing to see that a lot of times what drives our behaviors and our thinking is the result of things that have happened in the past. So this present moment mindfulness thing is not a clean slate, as much as we might like it to be. And the difference between sort of the way we think about maybe mindfulness in a secular way in Dharma is that the way that mindfulness and a lot of these kind of therapeutic tools, which I think are great, are kind of the pedagogy on that, the way that that's understood, is that we're trying to alleviate symptoms. So mindfulness-based stress reduction is a perfectly great example. Is that we use a lot of times mindfulness is trying to just alleviate symptoms, trying to make things a little easier, being a little bit more relaxed, being a little bit more content. And all of this is good. I'm not meaning this to be derogatory. It's all really helpful. But the thing I love about the Buddha's Dharma is we're not trying to alleviate symptoms. We're trying to eradicate the cause. We're not just trying to get through. We're not just trying to self. We're actually trying to really, really practice with enough diligence that we actually eradicate the cause and that we wake up. We overcome. You know, we're not just living with, we're actually abandoning the causes of suffering. Which I like that because it feels really actually empowering. And I'm not just trying to like get through, but I'm really going at my practice with the diligence of like, I'm going to eradicate this. I'm going to, as the Buddha says, I'm going to actually uproot the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. I probably won't, but I'm going for it. I'm not just trying to mask, or I'm not just trying to alleviate symptoms, which is kind of what we do in American culture. It's like, you know, you have a headache, you take an aspirin. We're always masking. You know, even in as much as I value it, but even the whole pharmacology industry is just trying to alleviate anxiety, depression, and stress, and just so we can make things more bearable. But they're not trying to eradicate the cause. They want you to be on the medication forever. Right? And so Dharma practice is this kind of, there's a difference that it's really kind of, and the promise and the hope in Dharma practice is that you can. And I really, really find that to be encouraging. So then this word Dharma, what is this word? I feel much more comfortable saying I'm a Dharma teacher than saying I'm a Buddhist teacher. But then if I say I'm a Dharma teacher and people don't know what that is, I have to explain, then I get into the weeds on Buddhism and it's a whole messy thing for me. But the reason I say that is, you know, the Buddha didn't teach Buddhism. The Buddha taught the Dharma. And Dharma practice, I was really kind of like, I do practice mindfulness and I do practice different Dharma practices, but I really feel like my core practice in life really is Dharma. I practice the Dharma. And what does that mean? It's a tricky word. But there's really kind of three ways that we can think about it. And it's really, really brings us into this area of addiction, I think, really, really well. I said this last night. You know, I had sat the 3-month retreat at IMS with about 30 days of sobriety, which I highly, highly do not recommend. Those of you who have been clean and sober from drugs and alcohol, if you remember day 30, it's not a picnic. Then I sat for 3 months after that. And at the end of that sit, end of the 3 months, I got a chance to ask some questions. And I asked Joseph Goldstein, who's been one of my primary teachers and really kind of the core leading teacher in the insight world, you know, did the Buddha ever say anything about addiction? And he ended up kind of coming to this understanding. He said, yeah, the whole of the Dharma is about breaking free and overcoming addiction. Not managing it, not like learning to live with it, not like masking the symptoms, but actually completely overcoming addiction. And I really, really found that to be powerful. So on the first level, we think about, Dharma is a concept, right? It's what the Buddha taught. And it's oftentimes translated as the truth or the way things are, but really the way things happen. And so it can be kind of the law. One of the translations for Dharma that I think is most interesting and probably feels the most true to me is nature. That everything has a nature to it. Just like the trees in the forest and things, the nature of a rainstorm or thunder, all these causes and conditions work in systems theory, in all systems, whether it's biology or chemistry or technology. There's systems in place. And the Dharma is the same way, except for the Buddha is really seeing it as the system of the mind. What is the nature of the mind? Right, the nature of the mind is to cling to pleasure and to push away pain. Do you have that nature in your mind? Right? That's part of Dharma. It's the nature. It's how it kind of, how the mind operates before we even get involved. Right? And so the thing I love about it in systems theory is the Dharma is an open system. And subtle, subtle changes can create profound consequences. Like in chaos theory, they talk about the idea of, you know, a bird's wing in Kansas will start a tornado in the, you know, in the Caribbean. That's where they find that to be a lot, and to be true in lots of systems theories. So why wouldn't it be true in the mind? If it's true, if everything else has this nature, and we know this through science, and whether it's physics or mathematics, or it's true everywhere else, so why wouldn't it also be true for the mind? And I really actually find that to be encouraging, that kind of thinking. And that we have this mind system. We all have the same system in it. We're all operating on the same operating system. Mind 1.0. Now, I don't know who designed it. I'm not necessarily very impressed with the operating system that I've inherited, but it is what it is, and I do my best to navigate it. I would like an upgrade. And I really actually think Dharma practice is this ongoing upgrading system. It takes forever. It's like on dial-up, you know. But, you know, we have nothing but time anyway. And so it's a concept, and that's sort of the way we think about it conceptually, and I could go on and on about that, but I'm not going to. It's also a practice, right? Dharma is something that we practice. And it's a practice of the cultivation of awareness and the cultivation of compassion. And so we practice those tools because those are the tools that end suffering. So why should I be more aware? Why should I be more compassionate? Well, those are, if the problem is I suffer because I don't see the world clearly, then I need to be aware of all the ways in which I don't see the world clearly. And I need to be compassionate and caring and involved in trying to alleviate that in myself and others. At least that's the theory. A pretty good theory. Almost 3,000 years old at this point. And so, you know, I think about, well, where and how did the Buddha, where did these ideas come from? He just, you know, he sat under this tree apparently and had this massive insight into these things. Probably that's not what happened, right? He probably, like the rest of us, grew up in a world and was conditioned and learned things. And there's this theory that I really, really like that comes from the early Buddhist tradition that really kind of, there's a book that was written by a kind of super academic, nerdy, Pali scholar named Richard Gombrich. He wrote a book called What the Buddha Thought, which is a book about how the Buddha might have been conditioned into his thinking. It's really actually fascinating. And he really comes up with this assumption that's really, really quite simple to imagine. The Buddha grew up in an agricultural society. He grew up on an alluvial plain in ancient India before there were cities, and he didn't grow up in a palace because there were no palaces at that time in ancient India. He probably grew up in a really nice mud hut, and his family were probably rich farmers. He might have been the richest farmer's kid living in the nicest mud hut, but that's about it. And, you know, he would have known about the sun. Sometimes there's this idea of the solar Buddha. He knew that the sun provided nutrients, and he knew that the sun was really what provided human flourishing. It's what grew the crops that they got to eat. It's what sustained life. And if we think about the sun, there's really two ways we can think about what the sun produces, and the first one is light. So with the sun, we can see. So really this idea of awareness and seeing clearly is an analogy for the sun, illumination. The ability to shine on things and be able to see objects very, very clearly. So the sun provides light and awareness. You can't be aware of much in the pitch black, can you? But as soon as the light shines, you can see all the objects very clearly. The other thing that the sun produces is heat, warmth, the warmth of compassion, the warmth of the heart. So he grew up in this world and knew this, and really, you know, part of the analogy around the systems is that he grew up in an agricultural world, so he was very aware of things like seed and fruit. So he knew that if you planted, let's just say an apple seed, which is, if someone gave you a bag of apple seeds to eat, you probably wouldn't eat one because they're not very much nutrition. But if you plant the apple seed in the earth and you give it care and attention and constant maintenance, over time, that apple seed will produce a delicious fruit apple that you can eat. So that's why he used the word bhavana, which means to cultivate, which really comes from agriculture. So the theory is that if that happens in the external environment, if that happens out there, who's to say that it's not the same for the mind? Wouldn't the mind also have the same nature? So we could take the idea of like compassion as a concept in the mind. And if I practice it, if I practice that seed of compassion, wouldn't it make sense that eventually I would have this fruition experience of actually feeling compassion for my suffering and for the suffering of others? If it's true out there, then why wouldn't it be true in here? Why would the mind be any different than any other system out there? And of course, it's turned into meditation, and it went through different countries and different languages. But that's really where it started, was that very same idea. Is this idea, and I love this analogy of seed and fruit. And this is true for every Dharma principle, whether it's generosity or loving kindness or gratitude or mindfulness. You know, we all have these potentials as human beings. You were born into this open system. But a lot of times what happens is we've been cultivating the seeds of worry and fear and contempt and anger. We've been cultivating those seeds. And then we wonder why we're so upset and so miserable. And people with addiction, one of the things I actually really will say, I sometimes feel like addiction and trauma has been a blessing, dare I say, because I wouldn't have the life that I would not have put this much effort into my Dharma practice if I had not suffered as much as I've suffered as a result of addiction and trauma. All the students that I've had, and I have quite a few students, all the ones who really, really are doing it, both of them have addiction and trauma because they got a lot of skin in the game, right? We got a lot of skin in the game because we know. I know how bad it can get. I've been there. I've seen the dark side of the mind, and I'm not going there. You know, I've seen what happens when you cultivate doom and fear and anger and resentment. I know what those fruits taste like, and I'm not really, not very good fruit. Not very healthy fruit. So one of the things about that is trying to flip the script on this whole addiction thing as being the stigma, sort of it can be kind of like, it kind of can be like a cancer diagnosis, like addiction. You have trauma, addiction, shame. It's like they're like, it's like we get, you know, these almost like these diagnoses as if there's something fundamentally, like we're fundamentally screwed. And I think it's actually very far from the truth. I don't feel screwed. I feel very, I feel like now I have this opportunity to go the other way. And because I've seen the dark side of the mind, I have a lot of skin in the game. I have very little doubt ever entering in my mind about the efficacy of Dharma practice. I very, very rarely have a moment of doubt that this stuff is just not the best thing to be doing. And really, that's really where the Buddhist tradition comes from. It's all about self-efficacy. If it works, do it. If it doesn't work, don't do it. You know, and a lot of times we don't give it, it takes a long time to get the seed to become a fruit. So if we look again at the definition of addiction, seed and fruit is not about short-term immediate gratification. You know? It's the long game. But if we hang in there long enough to start to see and to get that efficacy, that kind of like, I know because I know, and I cannot be convinced otherwise. You know, when that starts to take root in your practice, when you get that thing, it's like in that movie The Matrix, right? Once you take the blue pill, it's like, you know, you don't want to go back and eat the digital steak, right? You're like, no, like, I don't want to be in the crappy metal ship eating the oatmeal drool, but if this is the way out, then this is the way out. And it really kind of puts us in this whole paradigm shift. So I feel very encouraged by this stuff. I don't feel like my addiction or my trauma is a cancer diagnosis like I did much of my life. And I felt down about myself. I almost felt ashamed. You know, I must have done something to have deserved these terrible life experiences. But actually, without them, who knows? I could be selling, you know, Audis in San Diego and, like, you know, just be sort of as the Buddha calls them, an uninstructed worldling, kind of just moping about, you know, craving after pleasure and pushing away pain, getting nowhere fast, right? So I have a lot more to say, but I want to save some time for questions. So to just kind of say, so then there's a process, right? There's this concept of Dharma, there's this practice, there's this process, which really we could say is the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. There's actually a system, there is a trail of breadcrumbs that can get us out of that. And it really, it does depend on this kind of triangle of experience that we do. It's not just meditation. You know, it's sila samadhipanya. So it's really, and this has really been helpful for people with addiction, is really to not engage in behaviors that cause suffering to yourself and others. Sometimes called ethics or sila. But it's really actually about integrity, and it's about having discipline to integrity. So part of it is putting down the drink, putting down the drug, stopping that destructive behavior, no matter how painful it is. Once we get the long-term consequences, all of a sudden the short-term relief doesn't look so good anymore. Right? So there's that training in ethics, that training in sila. There's that training in the mind, which I just spoke about, the meditation practice. And then that arriving of wisdom, which is now we start to see the world more clearly. We start to see our role in the world more clearly. We start to see that we are all in this together, that we are interdependent beings. And even though we live in an individualistic society, most of my happiness in life comes from my relationships to other humans. That has been the greatest source, well, also of my sadness and misery too, but that's I'm moving away from that. Because I pick better people these days. But really, that's been the, and for many of us who aren't monastics, who aren't going to go meditate in a cave, who are going to live, That and especially this is true in recovery too, right, in the fellowship, really the greatest source of happiness for many of us is our relationships with other human beings and having authentic relationships and relationships where we can sit down and tell somebody anything is really, really part of that, this kind of sangha community aspect of Dharma. So I do want to take time for, time goes by so quick. So I do want to thank you for your attention. I have some announcements that I'll say at the end, but if anybody has any questions about anything I've said, now we can get into that. So thank you for listening.